True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
When Jean Domenico woke up on the morning of August 6, 2003, she didn't expect to die that day. She was a hard-working divorced mom of two teenagers, so every day was busy for her. After working one of her three jobs, Jean would go home to fix dinner and clean up the house for her son Charlie and her daughter Nicole. Nothing was more important to Jean than her children. For the past 3 years or so, 43-year-old Jean had been in a loving relationship with a co-worker named Chris McGowan. He got along well with Jean's children, and they planned a future together as a family. But in the months leading up to August 6th, Jean had been having trouble with 14-year-old Charlie, who was hanging out with a rough crowd, and 16-year-old Nicole, who had become obsessed with a new boyfriend. Join us at the quiet end for First Comes Love, Then Comes Murder. It was Chris McGowan who called the police after finding Jean unresponsive in her home. Interviews with Chris and Jean's ex-husband were done that evening, but Charlie, Nicole, and Nicole's boyfriend weren't immediately found. The police had their suspicions about what had happened to Jean, but then a confession that night would surprise them, devastate family members, and leave their New Hampshire community in shock.
Well, I'm glad you picked a New Hampshire case because I've been wanting to review some beers from Smutty Nose Brewing Company.
Yes, one of my good favorites.
Good beers. I love the name. So what we're doing with Smutty Nose for this case is its finest kind IPA. This is probably their flagship beer. It's an American IPA, 6.9% alcohol by volume. Gold color, medium-sized white head, little bit of lace, nice aroma, citrus and some floral aroma, grapefruit, little pine in the taste, nice hops, very good beer.
Okay, of course we both know this beer very well, something we used to drink on the regular, really.
Back in the day.
So this will be a nice nostalgic beer for us to drink. Let's open it up.
Okay.
Okay, Dickie, down here at the quiet end, and let's have a discussion. This is quite a story.
This really is. So let's get going. Jean Domenico's boyfriend, Chris, spent the night of August 5th at her house. Next morning was Wednesday, and that's a work day. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, Chris woke up to the alarm clock. He showered, he shaved, and got dressed as usual, and then he kissed Jean goodbye. He would see her at work later that morning. They both worked for the same company, Oxford Health Plans. Jean would show up a bit later, about 8:30. As the mother of two teenagers, she had things to do before heading out for the office. It was summer break, but she still liked to make sure that her kids had appropriate activities planned while she was away all day.
Yeah, doesn't mean those kids would follow those plans, though. I think she was a bit naive about some things. So Jean's house on Dumaine Avenue in Nashua, New Hampshire, was outside of the downtown area, and it was just a 20-minute drive to her office in Hooksett. When Chris stayed over on weeknights, he left the house early and was behind his desk before most of his co-workers even arrived. Now for Chris, who lived alone, Jean's house could be pretty hectic, and he could feel confined there. The house was a small New England-style Cape Cod with two small bedrooms and one bathroom. And Jean's 16-year-old daughter, Nicole, was living upstairs in the attic, which they had converted into a third bedroom. So space was pretty tight there.
Sounds like a small, cozy little house, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. You gotta love a Cape Cod.
Yeah. So despite the complications of dating a single mom, Chris was very much in love with Jean. From the first day they met, he was impressed by how different she was from the other women he had dated in the past. She had a stylish short haircut, rosy full cheeks, and an infectious smile. And she smiled a lot. She always seemed to be thinking of others and how to bring happiness to everyone she encountered.
Yes, and that would be something a lot of people would say about her, not just Chris. She was really well-loved.
Just one of those people that had the personality that got her along with everybody.
Yes. But if there's one thing that Chris tried to change about Jean, it was to get her to be a bit stricter with her kids. They left the house in a mess, and she didn't push them to help out at all. In fact, Jean had no problem working all day and then coming home to clean up their messes. And Chris thought they were too old to be so dependent on her. She worked hard after all, so why shouldn't they do their part and help out a bit?
Well, I would agree.
Yes, but she was already in this pattern, and it's really hard to break it.
Oh, terribly hard.
Yes.
But yeah, these are 14 and 16-year-olds. They can be expected to clean up after themselves.
They really should have been doing more, yes. So Chris, he lived by himself in a 3-bedroom ranch house just a few miles away, and he spent most weekends at Jean's house. But he didn't stay most weeknights. He was allowing the kids their space and Jean her space because, like I said, it's a small house.
Yeah. Plus, again, they haven't been dating that long, have they?
Well, long enough.
All right.
So during the week of August 6th, 2003, 16-year-old Nicole had a guest staying at the house, too, making things even more crowded. Nicole's boyfriend, 18-year-old Billy Sullivan, lived in Willimantic, Connecticut, with his mother and his 4 sisters. He had just dropped out after his junior year in high school, and he'd taken a job at McDonald's to help support his family. So that sounds really admirable, really. Not smart, I think, but admirable. Taking the job is good. Leaving school, I really don't think was a great idea.
Well, you know, if he had just dropped out after his junior year and he's 18 years old, he's already been held back at least 1 year, I would think.
Yeah, probably.
So school probably wasn't his thing.
Yeah, from what I've read, I don't think he was a great student, no.
So Nicole and Billy met in May of 2002 after he had sent an instant message to her. Now, as a teenager working her way through Nashua High School South, Nicole Kaczynskis was never part of a clique. Now, Kaczynskis was her father's name. When her mother divorced, Jean took her maiden name back. The kids kept their father's name, so she was Nicole Kaczynskis.
Yeah, she was kind of her own person, and that's a trait that Jean admired in her daughter. Nicole was bigger than many of her peers, but she really wasn't overweight. She was nice-looking enough and pretty smart. By the time she turned 13, before she met Billy, Nicole talked about wanting to date some boys in her school, but she never got up the nerve to initiate a conversation with them. Actually, because she was so shy, sitting at a computer and meeting people online was easier for Nicole, and I don't think that's that unusual. On May 10th, 2002, while visiting several different internet chat rooms, Billy had sent Nicole a random instant message, introducing himself and saying, "Can you help me get out some information on an ex-girlfriend?" So to me, that should have been a red flag right there that he's not a very nice guy. But maybe he was joking. Nicole just waited for a moment and then she typed in an answer, "Sure." And then over the next few days, they just chatted for hours. Their conversations online soon shifted from Billy's ex-girlfriend, whose reputation he wanted to destroy, to the two of them. So within a day, Nicole had already sent Billy her phone number, and after that, they talked for hours every day on the phone. On May 14th, just 4 days since they had begun chatting, Billy said, "I love you," to Nicole. Now, they'd never even met in person. But for some reason, Nicole felt Billy's emotion was genuine, and she would reciprocate.
Well, you know, they're 16 and 18. That's the sort of stuff you say.
Still seems quick to me, but yeah, I guess it could happen. And it could be fairly normal. But this does seem awfully fast.
Well, yeah, to us.
Yes. Because it had only taken days for the two to think they were in love, right?
Right.
And after months of discussions with Nicole, Jean had eventually agreed to let Billy stay at her house for a week. Now, she had already taken Nicole to visit Billy's house, and Jean had met Billy's mother. So he arrived at Nicole's on Friday, August 1st, and he was due to leave on August 7th. Jean asked Chris to stay over during the week to help her keep an eye on them. Billy seemed like a good kid, but of course she worried about him and Nicole being alone together. Just maybe not enough, because Jean and Chris had to work. So Nicole and Billy would be alone during the day. There was no avoiding that. But Jean was a bit naive, especially when it came to her daughter, Nicole. When she asked Chris to help her keep an eye on them, she'd added that she was sure Nicole wouldn't do anything because she was a good girl. And Chris had tried to give her a reality check. This was an 18-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl, he told her. They were home alone all day. Of course they're having sex.
Of course, that's obvious.
Right, but Jean shook her head. She knew her daughter, and in her mind, nothing would happen. When Jean and or Chris were home, Billy and Nicole were not allowed in her bedroom together. And incredibly, Jean seemed convinced that Nicole would follow those same rules, even when an adult was not there to supervise them. So there was really no history of Nicole dating any boys, so I can kind of see how Jean would have this naive outlook on Nicole. But now she has an 18-year-old boyfriend, you gotta really think what's gonna happen now. She is just a teenage girl.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a given that they're gonna have sex. I mean, they have time and the opportunity to do that. So, sure. Ever since Chris and Jean had begun discussing marriage, Chris had acted as a father figure for Nicole and Charlie, the 14-year-old. When Chris was at the house, he spent time with them playing board games or watching TV. But unlike Jean, Chris had some real serious concerns about Nicole and Billy's relationship. Things had been moving so fast that it was now too late to slow things down. Over their 15 months of long-distance relationship, Nicole and Billy had become very close, almost to the point of obsession.
Yeah, Dick, and I might even say not almost. I would say to the point of obsession.
So that's all these kids were thinking about, huh?
I think so. I mean, they were very obsessed with each other. And this was causing a great deal of tension between Nicole and her mom.
Well, of course.
Yeah. On the third day of Billy's visit, Jean had reminded them that Billy would be going back home on Thursday, August 7th. And she didn't plan on having him back anytime soon because Nicole had more important things to concentrate on, like school. But of course, this isn't getting through to Nicole. She's got this boy here, and they were kind of acting like they were married.
Well, yeah, they were getting to that point where they were going to run away and get married.
They were talking about it. But like any caring mother, Jean wanted her daughter to focus on her schoolwork, her involvement with the chorus, and to just take her time growing up. Before Billy had entered her life, Nicole had been very involved with the school chorus, and she had been an honor student as well. But now she seemed determined to spend the rest of her life with Billy. Jean didn't want Nicole to waste her life and forfeit her potential over a boy. The upcoming school year was important in her preparation for college, of course. But now with Billy talking about marriage, Jean was worrying that maybe Nicole would drop out of school. They'd been discussing sharing an apartment, and Billy had put together a list of household items they would need in their new life together. So this was childish, but it also showed that he was taking his relationship with Nicole too seriously. Way too fast.
Oh, I guess. Yeah, they'd been kind of a couple for 15 months, but not really. They'd met twice, right? She went to his place once, and he's been up at her house.
Yeah, maybe three times. Maybe she'd been to his house twice before. But yeah, they hadn't spent any significant time together.
No, so the concept that they're in love and can't live without each other is teenage stuff.
I think so. You know, Nicole really had no experience with boys. But on the other hand, Billy had actually slept with a few girls before, and he'd been kind of a player. So this wasn't so new to him, and I don't know how many girls he'd picked up on the internet, although he did seem to be only into Nicole at this point. Who knows how long that would have lasted. But Billy had written a letter to Jean, telling her how much he loved Nicole and how he had every intention of spending his life with her. He wrote that he and Nicole had discussed moving to Connecticut together and living with his sisters and his mother. It would all work out, he explained, because Nicole could transfer to a high school in Connecticut. And then he asked for Jean's blessing, but there's no way that was going to be given. He doesn't seem to realize how out of line the whole thing is. If he thinks this woman's going to let her 16-year-old daughter go off and live with him, that's pretty insane.
You could say that.
It's not something a responsible mom's going to agree to.
No, it's not.
Then 6 months after that letter, Nicole had written a similar letter to Jean. And she wrote about her love and devotion to Billy and explained that she wanted to be legally emancipated from Jean to be free to marry Billy. And this just wasn't the Nicole that Jean knew. This influence from Billy was clear, and it didn't set well with Jean or Chris. It was starting to seem also like Billy was controlling Nicole, and Nicole was going along with everything he said, which isn't surprising.
No, not at all. So weeks had gone by, and then Nicole brought up opening a joint bank account with Billy. And that's when Jean couldn't hold back her anger any longer. She had taught her daughter to be independent and self-sufficient. So on August 5th, Jean repeated to Nicole that Billy would be leaving for good, and there would be no further discussion about the relationship. It was time to step back from Billy for a while. He had been causing problems, and boundaries needed to be set.
Yes, so I'm totally on board with what Jean was saying there, but I just don't know if that's feasible in real life. How do you tell a 16-year-old you're not going to talk to this boy or see him for a long time? You're going to concentrate on school. It sounds good, but usually a teenager's not going to listen to that. She's already made up her mind.
Right, and she's always going to find ways around that issue.
Right, so, but I mean, it's really difficult. What was Jean to do? I really don't know.
She could send her to a nunnery.
A nunnery. Do those exist anymore?
I don't know.
Well, that wasn't a consideration. But I think you have a point there, even if you didn't mean to, in that the only way out would be to lock her up.
Well, I just don't think there's any way that things were standing in that family that Jean could be sure that there was no contact between Billy and Nicole.
Exactly.
So she's banging her head against the wall and not going to get anywhere.
But, you know, Jean hadn't had it easy. She was divorced, and she knew how one poor choice could follow you throughout your whole life. Her life had not been easy, and her marriage to Nicole and Charlie's father had been far less than ideal. It had actually been abusive. So he hadn't been a great guy, and he really hadn't played much of a role in his children's lives either. So let's talk a little bit about where Jean came from.
So Jean was born in Malden, Massachusetts in 1959. And her family moved to Braintree when she was young. So Malden and Braintree were quiet little suburbs located outside of Boston. Now, for kids growing up there in the 60s and 70s, it was a fun place to be. Candy was a big part of the local economy, and there were penny candy stores and soda fountains on just about every corner. There were some rougher neighborhoods, but Jean's childhood overall was a good one.
Yeah, she had well-educated parents, and like the other kids in her class, she fit in. She wore bell-bottom jeans, leather belts, and those bulky earth shoes of the 70s. She was very energetic and well-liked. So that hadn't changed. She was well-liked all the time. Her former neighbors described her family as close-knit also. And Jean's house had been a gathering place for the neighborhood children. Her mother was really good at looking out for all the kids in the neighborhood. So when Jean grew up and started her own family, she worked very hard to help support her family. After she and her husband divorced, she had to work several part-time jobs just to keep food on the table and pay the rent. She also volunteered at her children's schools. Since her divorce from Anthony Kaczynskis in 1999, Jean's focus had been on her two kids, and she worried about them, but she also trusted that they'd make good decisions. The life she had with her two children and Chris was simple, and it was far from glamorous, but just about everyone would agree that she was happy and really looking forward to the future.
While they were at the office on the day of August 6th, Chris McGowan and Jean didn't talk much. Chris stopped by and visited Jean's desk to chat a couple times, but they didn't discuss the situation with Nicole and Billy. Jean was determined to behave professionally and not to let her and Chris's relationship affect their work. So other than saying hello and sharing an occasional lunch, they didn't do more togetherness at work.
So it was close to 4:30 p.m. on August 6th when Chris walked over to Jean's desk. He wanted to let her know that he was leaving for the day. Since they'd begun dating, Chris rarely left the office without letting her know. So they decided that Chris would go home and shower and then meet her at her house between 7 and 7:30 p.m., Jean would pick up dinner for them on her way home. Jean liked to get pizza at this local pizza place that had a really good deal. On particular nights, the price of your pizza was based on the time you called to order it. And this began at 5 p.m. So Jean, always a bargain hunter, would call at exactly 5 p.m. to get the $5 pizzas. And she had a routine every night at 5:30 when she got home from work. She'd clean up the mess the kids had left from the day, which always happened, and then take care of some other chores. Chris told her many times that Nicole and Charlie needed to clean up after themselves. They left dishes and clothes and trash everywhere. And in Chris's opinion, this was just disrespectful to their mother. She worked so hard. But Jean didn't think twice about cleaning up their messes after she'd worked all day and they'd relaxed or done whatever they wanted all day. In fact, she didn't like it when Chris came over while she was cleaning up after them because he would tell the kids to do it themselves. And sometimes it would cause some friction.
Oh, I can bet.
Well, it's not easy to be the mom's boyfriend and try and set the rules when mom's not setting them.
Exactly.
It's not going to work.
No. So around the time Jean left work to go pick up the pizzas and drive home, Billy and Nicole left the house on Dumaine Avenue in Billy's black Chevy Cavalier. Now, this was a car Billy's mother had signed a $3,000 loan for a few weeks back. At around 4 o'clock that afternoon, a neighbor had seen Billy and Nicole playing around in the backyard, kind of like two school kids at recess, and they're giggling and poking each other. So this was going to be their last night together for a long time. Billy was supposed to go back home to Connecticut the next morning, and Nicole didn't know when he was coming back and did not know if she was going to be allowed to visit him in Connecticut. By now, they had started calling each other husband and wife. And then when Nicole had spent a weekend in Connecticut with Billy and his family late 2002, they'd even had a mock wedding ceremony officiated by one of Billy's little sisters. How cute. Since that day, Billy had referred to Nicole as his wife, and this made Nicole feel loved and secure, which were feelings she had longed for since her parents' divorce.
So I guess it would have been cute if he was 12 and she was 10 or something. I don't know if it's so cute for an 18-year-old. Kind of creepy to me. So
You didn't catch my sarcasm there, huh?
Sometimes I can't. You're very dry. So I'm glad you were being sarcastic, though, because it's really not very cute.
No.
So during the 15 months that Nicole and Billy were a couple, they had only seen each other a few times, like you said. And most teens will go through a stage where they feel that no one understands them. And for Nicole, Billy had come along right at that time. He'd love-bombed her, telling her everything she wanted to hear and just showering her with the attention that she probably hadn't gotten from her own father. But in all likelihood, what they had was not love. I don't think I even have to say that. It was lust.
You don't have to say that, but that's okay.
It was lust, and for Nicole at least, the relationship was filling a void. She really didn't have many friends at school, and she had experienced some bullying in her sophomore and junior years of high school. There'd actually been an incident where one of the girls had pulled her sweatpants down, not knowing that Nicole wasn't wearing underwear. So that had been quite humiliating. It was right in the schoolyard. So that had been a big thing, as you can imagine. And although she'd been a good student, she had been a bit lost on making future plans for college and a career. So being with Billy seemed to give her the security of having someone to plan a future with, no matter how unrealistic these plans were. They had discussed moving into Billy's mother's house in Connecticut together, and they'd even talked about running away to Vermont or New York State.
So as Chris drove home to shower and change that evening of August 6th, he was looking forward to a quiet Wednesday night of pizza, TV, and maybe a board game with Jean's kids. He felt confident that the situation with Billy and Nicole was going to resolve itself. Everybody went through the pains of first love, and it's going to pass. How true.
Well, you would hope that would happen, and in the majority of these cases, it probably does. But still, it's worrisome. If nothing else, you'd have to worry about a pregnancy, because that could really mess things up for her if she ended up getting pregnant from him.
Oh, no kidding.
Now remember, though, Chris had never married. He was this handsome guy, a bit stocky, but well-dressed and really friendly. But until Jean, he had lived the life of a bachelor. Also, his romantic life before Jean had some troubles. He'd been lied to and mistreated a lot, which had prompted a deep-seated mistrust of women in general. Back in the 1980s, after Chris returned to Nashua after working for an uncle in New Jersey, he'd met a woman who he began to see a possible future with. She was quiet and maybe a bit mysterious, which Chris saw as just, you know, she's a shy person. He knew that she did have an ex-husband and two children, and that the state had taken her children away from her. but for whatever reason, he never pushed her for details on that.
You know, I think I'd like to know why the state took my kids away.
Well, sure. If you'd been dating someone for 4 years, that's something you'd want to know, I think.
Yes.
But it kind of shows you that Chris had his own way of being naive also.
I guess he certainly did.
Because he was dating this woman for 4 years, and he knew that she had those two sons that she didn't have custody of. But on New Year's Eve, he'd bought her a nice piece of jewelry, and she told him that she had something to tell him. And that's when he learned that she had another child, a daughter, and that she and her ex-husband had both spent some time in prison. She'd actually been convicted of manslaughter.
Whoa.
So this shocked him.
I would think.
But, you know, he also kind of had to blame himself for not asking more questions during this relationship that, after all, had been going on for years. But after he learned that stuff, he stopped seeing her. And now he was happy because with Jean, things were as different as they could be. He absolutely trusted her and saw her as a partner for life.
So after he took a shower, Chris packed some clean clothes in his overnight bag. And according to what he later said, it was close to 7 o'clock by then. And he decided to phone Jean to see if there's anything she needed him to bring over. So he called. The phone rang 6 times, but no one answered. Now, when Chris hung up the phone, he was thinking, well, she's probably putting the dog out or taking him for a walk. It wasn't that unusual for Jean not to answer the phone. Jean was constantly doing things to stay busy. Keep busy, Jean always said. Keep active. Keep focused. Healthy heart, healthy mind.
So Jean's son Charlie was at a friend's house, and according to a note Billy had left on the kitchen counter at Jean's house, Billy and Nicole were at a local bowling alley playing pool. At the bottom of this short note, Billy said that if Jean needed to find the two of them, she should call his cell phone. Now, this note wasn't really out of the ordinary. Nicole had always been good about telling Jean where she was, and Billy had felt comfortable leaving notes at the house that week while he was staying there. At his house, Chris checked his email and decided to try calling Jean at home one more time. Now it was a few minutes after 7, but she still wasn't answering, so that was unusual. When Chris went out to his car, he looked at his cell phone, which he had left on the front seat. So it was 7:15 p.m. now, and he was hoping to see a message from Jean. But instead, he saw that Nicole had left him a voicemail about 5 minutes earlier. So he listened to the message, which was long and meandering. Nicole said, "Chris, I was unable to reach anyone at home. I just tried calling the house. My mom's not home yet. It's getting late. I figured she'd be with you. Just wanted to let you guys know me and Billy will be late for dinner." Then she added, "It's Billy's last day here. He's going back to Connecticut tomorrow." Now she sounded calm with no glitch in her voice. And Chris heard Billy in the background telling her to let Chris know where they'd be and how long they'd be out. Then Nicole said, "It's getting kind of late, so we're just wondering if she's with you. We really don't know when we'll be back. Call us on Billy's cell phone if you need me."
Then before pulling out of his driveway, Chris saved that voicemail, and he decided to call Jean again. Still no answer. But Chris still wasn't worried. He thought that Jean might have been dropping Charlie off at a friend's house, or that she might be across the street talking with the neighbors. Once he got closer to the house, Chris stopped at a 7-Eleven and bought a soda. Took him about 4 minutes to walk into the store and get back to his car. He picked up his cell phone one more time to check in to see if Jean had called, but she hadn't. He's in sight of her house, so he can look towards her house from the 7-Eleven parking lot, and he could see that her car was there.
Yes, so the 7-Eleven was located right behind Jean's house, so it was easy for him just to glance over. Just a short time earlier, between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m., Nicole and Billy had been parked at that same 7-Eleven store. They were desperate to stay together, and they were trying to find a way to keep Billy from having to leave her and return to Connecticut. They were asking themselves why nobody understood that their love was real. Nicole was not willing to stand outside of her house on Thursday and wave goodbye to Billy, not knowing when or if she'd ever see him again. Billy had spent the past 5 days at the house, and for Nicole it had been wonderful. Besides a few arguments Nicole and Jean had had about it, Billy's stay had been perfect for Nicole. Nicole had even overheard her mother telling Chris how easy the week with Billy had been. So that evening, Nicole was confused about what to do. She wanted to try and talk to her mother one last time and ask her why she was being so stubborn. Billy was leaving the next day. There was nothing they could do about it, and Jean would not change her mind. They had discussed running away. They had even gone to the library and looked up directions to upstate Vermont and Niagara Falls. But, you know, they didn't have enough money to get very far or to stay anywhere for any period of time. So it just wasn't realistic. Besides, Nicole's a minor.
Yep, she is. Tough to get married. But she talked about being an emancipated minor.
She was very focused on doing that, yeah.
Or she could get her mother's permission, which wasn't going to happen.
No.
So as Chris pulled into Jean's driveway after he left the 7-Eleven, he saw one of the family dogs, and this was a Shih Tzu named Buster, out in the backyard on his leash. Jean sometimes tied Buster outside when she got home from work so he could pee after being cooped up in a crate in the house for most of the day. Jean couldn't rely on Charlie or Nicole to let him out regularly.
Well, I don't think she could rely on those kids to do really anything. They eat the food and, yeah, sure.
Now, Jean also had a husky named Princess, and Princess was in a doghouse in the backyard. Chris grabbed the bottle of soda from his front seat and walked toward the front door. He's confused, as Jean should have let Buster back into the house by now. He noticed that Buster was behaving oddly. He was just jumping around anxiously and kind of yelping. Something was bothering Buster.
Oh, absolutely. Now, also, there were no lights on in the house. Looking at the door, Chris then noticed that it was ajar. It seemed like no one was home, though. So Chris went inside and called out for Jean. Although he didn't notice when he first walked in, the coffee table in the living room was broken into pieces. The kitchen was a big mess, too. Things were just out of place all over. Jean never would have left things like this, he knew. It looked like there had been some kind of a struggle in the house. So as Chris got to the kitchen from the doorway, he saw that the refrigerator door was open also. Chris saw Jean's feet first. She was lying face down on the floor. He at first assumed that she had tripped and hit her head on the corner of the stove. Or maybe she'd passed out for some unknown reason and hit her head. Over the past few days, Chris remembered, Jean had been complaining about not feeling like herself. She had actually called her doctor on Monday, August 4th, after telling Chris that she felt tipsy, dizzy, and fatigued. So he had to think maybe this was related. Jean was always watching her weight. She'd gained some weight in the past several years, but then over the past couple of months, she'd lost several pounds on the Atkins diet. So now Chris wondered if her weight loss, fatigue, and dizzy spells were actually related to some serious illness. As he stared at Jean, getting no response, Chris noticed then that there was a large pool of blood underneath her head and shoulders. She had actually bled all over the floor, and it was still wet. What Chris didn't notice at the time was that there was also blood all over Jean's kitchen. It was on the refrigerator, the cabinets, the baseboards, the table, the chairs, and the floor. Even the carpet in the living room had some splotches of blood. Even the stairs had droplets on them, too. So after Chris noticed this blood, he reached for the home phone, which was on a small shelf between the kitchen and the living room. And the horror of the situation was beginning to set in. He began shaking.
Now, to the 911 operator, Chris sounded panicked and confused, almost close to being hysterical. He gave the operator the facts, and she asked him to check if Jean was breathing. She wasn't. The operator tried to keep Chris focused on details, but he began to cry as different scenarios of what could have happened to Jean entered his thoughts. It began to sink in that something violent had happened inside Jean's house and that Jean was very badly hurt. And it occurred to him that there could be an intruder in the house that very minute. So it seemed to Chris that whatever had happened to Jean had just happened within the past half hour or so. He wasn't sure if she had fallen or if someone had attacked her. When the ambulance arrived, Chris had been kneeling beside Jean. He noticed that her eyes were open, and he realized she was dead. A police officer, who was only 1 mile away from Jean's house, responded to a report of a sudden death. When he arrived 3 minutes later, Chris was waiting at the door, just looking really lost. Dispatch had reported a man had called in to report a woman lying on the floor of her home, and the woman was unresponsive. So after a few more minutes, more officers arrived, as well as EMTs and firefighters. The police had to consider that Chris may have killed Jean. If Jean had been killed by a stranger, they then had to make sure that her killer was no longer in the house. And there could be more victims, too. Where were Charlie, Billy, and Nicole? So the house was searched to make sure no one else was there. And for all Chris knew, Billy, Charlie, and Nicole could have been upstairs. But there's no one else in the whole house.
Jean's next-door neighbor, Rita, was looking out her window when she noticed two people standing by the side of Jean's house. She couldn't tell who they were through some shrubs blocking her view, but she thought it was Chris and Jean. She thought that the couple was out there talking. So this was the perfect opportunity, Rita thought, to talk to Jean about something she had found out about Nicole the day before. So Rita was a 29-year-old mother of three children. She and her husband and children lived next door to Jean for the past 2 years, and they were very friendly. Nicole had recently started babysitting Rita's kids, too. And through that, Rita and Nicole had become friendly. Sometimes Nicole confided in Rita about her teenage problems that she couldn't discuss with her own mom. So the previous day, Nicole showed up to babysit, but she had seemed preoccupied. And Rita had asked her what was wrong. And Nicole had asked Rita if she would go to the store and buy a pregnancy test for her, because Nicole was worried that she was pregnant. Now Rita knew that Nicole had been seeing Billy, and she'd even met him. She thought he was polite but very quiet. She knew Nicole loved Billy and that she had been having sex with him. So, Jean didn't know, but the neighbor knew. Nicole had told Rita that Billy was her first, and Rita had agreed not to tell Jean, but she knew that she had to. She knew that she would. When she had a chance, she planned to let Jean know exactly what was going on with her daughter. So Rita had gone to the store and bought a pregnancy test while Nicole waited at her house, and with Rita still there, Nicole had gone into the bathroom and taken the test. It was negative, and Nicole had seemed relieved. But now Rita, believing that Chris and Jean were outside talking, was going to tell Jean the results of that test. So she left her house and walked across the lawn, but then she noticed police cruisers and ambulances parked along the street. Officers were actually blocking off the area with yellow crime scene tape. "What the hell is going on?" Rita asked no one in particular. And then she saw Chris. As she approached him, Rita noticed it wasn't Jean standing there beside Chris at all. It was a police officer. "Chris," Rita asked, "what is going on here?" But Chris had a hard time responding at first. Then he said, "She has to be dead. There's blood everywhere. I don't know how she can still be alive." Then he fell to his knees and cried. When he finally stood back up, he walked around as an officer followed him wherever he went. But Rita's kids were home alone, so she was worried about them and she had to go back to her house. As she walked back to her house, she saw more police cars showing up. The entire street was blocked off now. While Chris stood outside of Jean's house, a detective was asking him questions. Information that could be important to finding Jean's killer needed to be documented immediately. Chris might have known something important about the case without even realizing it. Also, as far as detectives knew, Chris was their prime suspect. It's her boyfriend and he found her. Chris wasn't pressured to answer any tough questions, though, relating to the murder scene at that point. Detectives could tell he really wasn't thinking clearly.
So this caused quite a bit of excitement in the neighborhood, with the police cars, the ambulance, all sorts of things, commotion going on. So there's a lot of neighbors out in the street. The avenue is lined with crime scene investigation trucks and evidence vans. Uniformed officers are knocking on doors asking questions. Now, Jean's ex-husband was the most popular topic of conversation among the many people standing out front. Anthony Kaczynskis had a history of being in trouble with the law, and Jean was terrified of him. There was no doubt Jean had concerns about Anthony. She had often called neighbors during the day when the kids were home alone and asked them to go check on the kids. Her biggest fear, several neighbors said, was that Anthony would show up at her house unannounced. And she had called less when Chris began staying overnight, but she was still afraid of Anthony, and she always worried that he would kill her. When Anthony and Jean got divorced, Jean made it clear that she wanted to drop his name, and she went back to court to change her last name back to Domenico. She gave the kids the option to do the same thing, but they both chose to keep their dad's name.
So as the night wore on and the facts of Jean's death sunk in, Chris had a hard time accepting that he was never going to see Jean again. Of course he did. By 9 o'clock, Chris was getting frustrated that he still didn't know how Jean had died. Reliving the scene in his mind, all Chris could think of as he stood outside Jean's house was that she had fallen and hit the back of her head on the corner of the stove. Nothing else made sense. For the whole time he was at the scene, though, a police officer shadowed Chris, watching everything he did.
Yeah, because in the eyes of the police, Chris was at the top of their list for suspects. After all, he was the boyfriend, and he had been the one to find Jean. He didn't have a solid alibi to back up where he had been either, and didn't have anyone who could say where he was at the time of Jean's death. So the police asked him to go to the station for some formal questioning, which he did. And he would later say that he never felt like he was treated as a suspect in Jean's death.
Yeah, they never tried to just take him down to the station and get him to confess, which I think some police would have done. So it seems like they handled things pretty reasonably.
By the book.
Yeah. So Billy Sullivan's mother, Patricia, was in her Connecticut home when she got a call from Billy at about 7:30 p.m. that night. According to her, Billy sounded calm. He explained he and Nicole had been driving around town most of the night. They were shopping, he said. Just two kids in love spending their final night together. As the scene back at Jean's house was being examined, Nicole and Billy were driving around town. So unless they'd been watching the scene from afar, neither could have known that police were there collecting evidence. While they were out, Billy stopped at a nearby shopping mall, where Nicole bought him a new pair of socks and a t-shirt. Then Billy had changed clothes just down the street from Jean's house in the parking lot of the local movie theater. Nicole had called home a few times, but of course no one answered, so she had left messages saying she and Billy were running late and would be home as soon as they could. After all, this was their last night together. They had to make the best of the time they had left. So after Billy spoke to his mom, Nicole suggested that they just drive to his mom's house in Connecticut. But Billy said, well, that's not a good idea because the police will be at my door the next day asking questions. So after leaving the movie theater parking lot, Billy drove to Rebecca's, a friend of Jean's, house. Rebecca was Jean's best friend, and she lived about 3 miles away from Jean's. Jean, Billy, Nicole, Charlie, and Chris had helped her move into that house on Friday, August 1st. Some of her things were still unpacked and in boxes. Jean and Chris had volunteered to come back the following Saturday, and they would help her unpack and clean. Rebecca had known Jean for nearly 15 years. They had worked together before, and they were very close. Like Jean, Rebecca was a single woman who'd worked hard just to make ends meet. She was employed by a healthcare company in Andover, Massachusetts, so Rebecca had to get up at 4 a.m. to get to work on time. So most nights, she was in bed by 8 p.m.
And around 10:05 p.m., Billy and Nicole knocked on Rebecca's door. She wasn't asleep yet, but she had the lights out and she had gotten into that snoozy kind of stage of sleep. Now, she seemed to be a little annoyed at being wakened up and she let them in. Billy seemed hyped up and jittery. Nicole was more relaxed, but she seemed very sad. Both the kids looked exhausted, but Rebecca chalked this up to their emotions about being separated again, because Billy was going back to Connecticut the next day. If I look a little jittery or jumpy, Billy said to Rebecca, it's because I had a Coke earlier. She wasn't real interested at the time. She just wanted to get back to bed. So she finally asked him to leave so she could get some sleep. But she didn't want to kick them out. She felt that being Jean's best friend, it was nice of Nicole to bring Billy over. But it was getting late. Nicole, Rebecca said, it's after 10. Your mother let Billy stay here for a week. She must be worried about you. I know, said Nicole. So Rebecca picked up her phone and called Jean's home. No one answered. Then she tried calling Chris. Still, no answer there either. They're probably out looking for you right now, Rebecca said. She also said, it's pretty selfish of you to do this to her. Why don't you just go home? Billy agreed, saying that they were tired and he would go back and sleep on Jean's couch.
Yeah, so meanwhile, Chris was in a small room where the Nashua police had put him for an interview. In the fluorescent lights, he could now clearly see that both of his arms, from his shoulders to his fingertips, were covered in blood. He was wearing shorts, so his knees were covered from when he had knelt down beside Jean. Two detectives sat Chris down at a small table, gave him a glass of water, and told him to relax. He waited for them for what seemed like hours, but was only 10 to 15 minutes. As he sat there, he imagined his life without Jean in it. He and Jean had been planning the rest of their lives together, and now all of a sudden she was gone. When one of the detectives came back into the room, he asked Chris, "When was the last time you saw Miss Domenico?" He said it was at work that day because they worked together, and then he explained how they had plans to meet at her house. Then Chris became nervous, suddenly worried as he thought about Charlie and Nicole. This had really been on his mind, how he was going to explain to Charlie and Nicole what had happened to their mother. Charlie had been at a friend's house, and Nicole had been out with Billy, and apparently the police were trying to locate them.
And then when he was asked if Jean had any enemies, Chris said that the last person on Earth to have an enemy would be Jean. Then he thought of Jean's ex-husband, Anthony. In the meantime, the police had located Anthony, and he had a solid alibi. When discussing the two kids, Chris said that Nicole was a model student and daughter. Then the mention of Charlie as a possible suspect disturbed Chris. He couldn't imagine that Charlie had something to do with Jean's death. But as he sat and thought about the times Charlie had lost his temper with Jean, he had to admit that Charlie had been at odds with his mother in the months leading up to her death. So for a brief moment, Chris thought that it could have been Charlie. Things had to be the way Charlie wanted, or he would yell and throw a fit. He had put his fist through his bedroom door more than once when he got angry with Jean. Chris knew this because he had replaced the door more than once. As a single mother, Jean had had her hands full with these two teenagers. There had been problems at school and with friends. Now, most of this was typical teenage angst, but now everything said in the home was being reviewed under a microscope.
Well, the police knew that Jean hadn't fallen in the kitchen and split her head open. And it hadn't been a burglary gone wrong, either. Detectives knew immediately upon entering Jean's home that she had been brutally beaten with some sort of blunt, solid object, and then stabbed repeatedly with two different knives. An early estimate was that Jean had been stabbed 40 to 50 times. She had wounds to her face, neck, head, and throat, as well as many defensive wounds on her hands. Investigators had found a broken knife handle inside Jean's kitchen sink, and the blade was on the floor. Two more knives were found out in her backyard. Now here's an interesting thing. Jean was very much against having any knives in her house. Even normal, everyday kitchen knives to carve meat or butter knives were not welcome there. As detectives continued to question Chris, he made a point to tell them that Jean hated all knives. It was kind of odd. When he first started dating Jean, Chris thought it was weird that a woman who cooked dinner every night for two teenagers didn't even own a simple set of knives. Chris had found out about this in the spring of 2000, when he grilled steaks in Jean's backyard. When he'd finished cooking, he'd walked into the kitchen to carve the meat. But after looking through the drawers for a knife, he couldn't find any. So Jean told him she hated knives. She was terrified to have them, and she didn't own any. When Chris brought up with detectives that Jean was frightened of keeping knives in the house, they asked him for more details. To detectives, it almost seemed that Jean had this eerie sixth sense and fear that she was going to be attacked by someone with a knife. So it was strange. And then, thinking differently now about the past year, Chris couldn't help but think about how the knives that had likely killed Jean had ended up in her house. Chris and Jean had been shopping one day when Chris came upon a nice, inexpensive cutlery set. Although she was still apprehensive, Jean had agreed to buy them. As Chris sat and spoke with detectives, he explained that Jean was partly scared of keeping knives in the house because she worried about her son, Charlie. She didn't like for him to have access to knives or anything dangerous like that because Charlie had a bad temper. Chris believed that Jean didn't want to keep knives in his reach because she was afraid that Charlie might reach for one in the heat of an argument. So that got police thinking more about Charlie.
Well, I would think. But if there's that much of a behavioral issue with him, was he seeing a psychiatrist or anything?
I don't think so.
So it was just kind of normal stuff that I'm afraid my 14-year-old's going to stab me.
Well, yeah, it's a bit much, I know. but that's how she felt, and I can kind of see it. You know, I went through a time period where I wouldn't have a butcher block of knives on my counter, just because the horror movies, they always grab one from there before they murder you.
Well, that's where you get the knives, yeah.
Yeah, but being afraid that her son might grab one, that's kind of concerning about Charlie, isn't it?
It really is. It was after 8 o'clock when Charlie did show up at his house and saw all the commotion going on. And when he learned what had happened, he was devastated and he fell to the ground sobbing. And he immediately voiced regret for butting heads with his mom. He did have an alibi, and he was taken to the police station to be interviewed before his father, Anthony Kaczynskis, came to the police station and picked him up.
Yeah, he was taking him to live at his house, because where else is he going to go now?
There's no place. Before Charlie left, Chris put his arm around Charlie and told him, "We're going to be okay. We're going to get through this. Are you going to be okay going with your father?" And Charlie said that he would be. Then Charlie looked Chris in the eyes and said, "He did it." Chris asked him what he meant, and Charlie said, "Billy." Chris couldn't believe what he was hearing. He told Charlie it couldn't be true. But Charlie was adamant. He said he knew Billy had killed Jean.
So there's an interesting twist.
This little teenager comes up with this stuff. He must have been I would imagine the three kids at home all day alone.
Yeah, right, right.
A lot of conversation and stuff.
Yeah, so he probably had a better idea about what's going on with Billy and Nicole than Chris or Jean would have.
I would think, yeah.
So about 10:15 that night, Nicole and Billy arrived back at the house. There were still several crime scene investigators and detectives on the scene, and a neighbor was standing in the street in front of Jean's house when he recognized Billy's car inching its way up the street, and he pointed that out to police. Jean's house was close to the corner of Dumaine Avenue and Amherst Street. Police had Dumaine blocked from Amherst. Just east of Dumaine was the corner where the 7-Eleven store sat across the street. Standing in Jean's backyard, you could see the 7-Eleven and the bank. Billy had driven by the roadblock from that direction. Nicole's window was down as Billy drove closer. Several police officers stood in front of the car with their hands up, telling him to stop. Then officers rushed to each side of the car as Nicole and Billy got out of the car. Nicole asked them what was going on. Most neighbors and friends who knew Nicole and Jean were very concerned for Nicole and wondered how she was going to react to losing her mother. Nicole had always been very close with her mom, so it was important for the police to get independent stories from Nicole and Billy. They were separated and taken to the police station in separate police cars to be interviewed. Billy was very talkative, and then he began coughing and dry heaving. After Billy was put in an interview room at the Nashua police station, he remained talkative. He was read his rights and agreed to speak without an attorney. Then he spontaneously volunteered that he didn't like police officers, and he said that he had been charged with crimes he didn't commit in the past as a juvenile. Then Billy started talking about shopping with Nicole that evening. He said they walked around, but they didn't end up buying anything.
At first, Nicole stuck to the story that she and Billy had agreed on. She even showed the detectives receipts for stores they had been to and evidence that they had signed in at the bowling alley that evening. She said that she called her mother several times to let her know where they were, but Jean didn't answer. Then she left a message with Chris McGowan. She said that she and Billy had then seen a 7 p.m. showing of Pirates of the Caribbean, but Nicole in her interview said that she had also bought some socks and a t-shirt for Billy while they were shopping, and Billy felt the need to wear them that night for some reason, and he had changed clothes just down the street from Jean's in the parking lot of the local movie theater. And after that, the two had driven to Jean's friend Rebecca's house. The two detectives who had spoken with Billy and Nicole separately met to compare notes, and that's when they realized there were some big inconsistencies in the stories. They returned to the interviews, this time with recording equipment on.
Well, you know, by this time, Billy and Nicole's stories were quickly falling apart. While Billy spoke to two detectives in one room, Nicole was really spilling the beans in a second room down the hall. Nicole changed her story to one where Billy had been protecting her from her mother in a fight, and he had had no choice but to kill Jean. She said her mother had come at her with a knife, so Billy had struck her with a baseball bat. Of course, police did not believe this story either, and Nicole finally did begin to tell the truth. one of the first details pertaining to her mother's murder that Nicole brought up really shocked the investigators. Giving all of the details, Nicole admitted that, over the past week, she and Billy had tried to kill her mother 4 times, but it hadn't worked.
4 times?
Yeah, so this is something they'd been working on.
Jeez.
Yeah, a lot more planning going into this than you would have thought.
Well, again, mom's gone all day. You got a lot of time.
That's true. So according to Nicole, the 3 previous murder attempts took place in the 4 days leading up to Jean's murder. The first attempt was when they had added Dimetapp, Benadryl, and ibuprofen to Jean's coffee creamer. Nicole said Billy believed that if they laced the creamer and Jean ingested enough of it, she'd die. Over a period of time, Billy explained, Jean would become sick and drop dead from an overdose. So although it was Billy's idea and he put the over-the-counter medication into Jean's creamer by himself, Nicole claimed that she stood by him and watched. And she admitted to being culpable because she hadn't tried to stop him. But this is so ridiculous. Because, for one thing, it takes a lot to overdose on those medications. And how much coffee creamer does a person use? A tablespoon or two? So all of these ideas are kind of harebrained.
Yeah, well, they're the kinds of ideas that you'd expect a kid to come up with.
I know, but this guy's 18.
Yeah.
Let's not give him too much slack for being a kid.
He's still a kid.
Well, Nicole had told Billy that night that it wasn't working. Jean had felt dizzy, Chris admitted later, and she had gotten sick. But she was able to go to work that day and function just fine. That Dimetapp can make you dizzy in a normal dose.
Yeah. I mean, I think at worst, like you said, it might make you sleepy.
Right, right. So Billy suggested the next day that they try something else. And that night, when Jean and Chris were asleep, Nicole and Billy stood in the kitchen with the lights off, and they added bleach to her creamer. Now, this is no better.
No. Nope.
Can you imagine how horrible it would taste with bleach? You don't just drink bleach and not notice it.
There would be a giveaway there, wouldn't there?
Yes. So the next morning, after Jean and Chris had left for work, Billy and Nicole had gone into the kitchen. Jean had thrown the creamer away, believing it had gone bad. So there's 2 down.
Yeah, then the next day, Billy came up with another plan. They would set her mother's room on fire. So they're standing in Jean's room. Billy looked around trying to figure out the best place to leave a burning candle so it would make it look like an accident. While Billy searched for the right spot, he asked Nicole to go get him a lighter because we want to make sure her blanket's flammable.
Of course, you have to check that.
So Nicole returned with a 12-inch disposable lighter, and she snapped the trigger and held the flame up to Jean's blanket. But it was one of those darn flame retardant things, and it wouldn't ignite.
Hate when that happens.
Yeah. There goes another plan.
So, 3 ridiculous plans, but the 4th one might be the stupidest I've ever heard of.
Yeah. This is a great one, isn't it?
Yes.
And it's just another example of his stupidity and immaturity, I guess.
Absolutely.
So, he bought 2 sections of clothesline rope at the Home Depot. And he told Nicole his plan. You feed the rope into the oil tank out in back of the house, and I'll keep your mother and Chris busy. Then we'll pour gasoline along the rope and light it. And as the flame gets into the oil tank, the house is going to blow up.
Right. So for people who haven't lived in New England and aren't familiar with this setup, for heating, many people in New England have a large oil tank outside of their house, which you get filled and fueled up to keep your house warm, right?
Right.
And that's what they had. So they're hoping the house will blow up. But first, Billy told Nicole, you need to get everything out of your room that you want to keep. That's important.
Very. When they got back, Nicole went into her room, threw her diary and some clothes into a bag. Then she went outside. Now, while Billy was inside the house talking to Jean and Chris, keeping them busy, Nicole put the rope into the oil tank and unraveled the rest of it into the backyard, heading out toward the edge of the lawn. Yep. I have visions of this rope like 25 feet long.
I know. If this wasn't such a sad story, this is just hilarious.
So the rope's in the oil tank, and she's unraveling the rest. Billy promised the rope would act as a fuse, and once it burned down and touched the fuel, it would ignite the tank and blow up the house.
Yeah. Now, in a book about this case by M. William Phelps, he actually compared this to the coyote and the roadrunner type of deal, which I thought was funny.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
So Nicole's dragging the end of the rope to the edge of the yard, and she heard Billy and Chris talking on their way outside. So when she's talking to the police, Nicole said, "I didn't want anybody to see me, so I just ran. I ran to the back of the house with the rope in my hand because I didn't want to leave it out there. Because she'll get caught."
Well, yeah, but she just looked ridiculous.
So there goes another great plan.
Yeah. So after that, Nicole and Billy decided to kill Jean in a way that wouldn't destroy the house and wouldn't risk hurting Chris or Charlie. So yeah, that's big of them.
Yeah. Maybe they could have come up with those plans before they tried these other things. Anyway.
Perhaps. Now, detectives were stunned by the coldness that Nicole showed towards her mother in the planning of this murder. Sitting with Nicole, they asked her to explain how things had escalated to the point where, as Nicole was now admitting, Billy walked into the house and bludgeoned and stabbed Jean. "My mom didn't want Billy and me to see each other anymore," Nicole told them. "I wanted to go live with Billy in Connecticut, and my mother would never have let me do that." So that's her reasoning.
That's
not going to hold up in court very well.
I wouldn't think. Before the night was over, Nicole shared another shocking revelation. And as the interview continued into the early morning hours of August 7, Nicole admitted that she had gone into the house after Billy killed Jean. She had gone back to the house to get a towel for Billy, and as she did that, she had to step over her mother's dead body.
So that's pretty horrible.
Very.
Now, Billy eventually confessed to the police that he had killed Jean, so that he and Nicole could live together in Connecticut. So this was clearly premeditated, and it was brutal. When some facts of the case were made public on the morning of August 7th, the people who had loved Jean Domenico couldn't believe that her teenage daughter was behind her murder, and they thought this had to be some kind of a mistake. Billy must have threatened her, or forced Nicole to take part, and told her what to say if she was questioned. Maybe he had even threatened to kill Nicole, too. Everyone admired the way Jean had cared for Nicole and Charlie, and how she'd worked herself ragged just to support them. Despite working 3 jobs and still barely making ends meet, Jean had had a positive attitude about everything, and nothing seemed to stop her from enjoying life and continuing to care about other people. So they just couldn't understand this.
Well, it is kind of incomprehensible.
Oh, it sure is. So on the morning of August 7th, Attorney General Peter W. Heed and the Nashua Police Chief, Donald Gross, sent out a brief 1-page press release, which read in part, "William Joseph Sullivan, Jr., age 18, of Willimantic, Connecticut, has been arrested on charges of first-degree murder in connection with the homicide of Jean Domenico, age 43, of Nashua, New Hampshire." Whatever Billy had told the police was enough to arrest him and hold him for murder, but there was more. After a brief description of the charges against Billy, adding how he had repeatedly stabbed Jean, the press release then gave the most shocking part of the story. The murder charges alleges that Billy acted in concert with and was aided by a 16-year-old juvenile. Related charges have been brought against the minor. So, of course, that means Nicole.
Yeah, it's easy to read between the lines.
Yes. So that morning of August 6, 2003, had been steaming hot. There was 95% humidity in Nashua. The air conditioner in Jean's house was on the highest setting, and Billy and Nicole woke up around 11 a.m., leisurely morning. I guess they weren't too stressed out about their plan. Now they had the house to themselves, and they sat together on the couch and talked about killing Nicole's mother. They had discussed a plan the day before and decided to sleep on it. Now they had decided to go through with it. They'd be better off without Jean, and they could begin their lives together right away. "Well, if only my mom wasn't so protective," Nicole had said. "You have a car. We can just leave." But Billy shook his head. "Yeah, right. And the cops will be knocking on my door in 2 days. So they showered, they had breakfast, and they left the house. Billy would later explain how the plan came together when he and Nicole started talking about it that afternoon. And the more they talked about it, the more convinced they became that it would work.
Jeez.
I know it. It's crazy.
So around 4:40 p.m., Billy suggested they go bowling at Lita Lane's. They had been driving around all afternoon, weighing their options and trying to get up enough courage either to run away or to confront Jean. Bowling sounded fun to Nicole. Plus, it was the perfect place to create an alibi, which is the real reason they went there. Lita Lane's was just a 5-minute drive from Jean's house.
Well, Billy and Nicole kept talking about how depressed they would be if Billy went back to Connecticut the next morning without her. This was driving all of their decision-making, and they believed that the separation was going to be devastating for both of them. Spending that past week together had made the bond between them stronger, and Billy's leaving was just now impossible for them to accept. Billy told Nicole, "If something would happen to your mom, then you'd have no choice but to come to Connecticut and live with me." So that's not even accurate, because she does have a father. The father took Charlie.
Yeah, where does she think she'd go?
She thinks she'd go with Billy. So earlier that afternoon, Nicole had cried to Billy, "I just want more than anything to be with you." She'd said she wished her mom understood that what she and Billy had wasn't some teenage romance built on lust, but it was a true love that was going to last forever. Killing Jean had been a joke between them for quite a while, but now, during this visit, it was becoming a real plan. Billy's initial idea of knocking some sense into Jean turned into killing her, and Nicole was going along with this. Billy and Nicole stayed at Lita Lane's for 30 minutes, according to the slip Billy filled out to rent pool balls. And after they left Lita Lane's, Billy drove to Dunkin' Donuts, which was just down the street. They sat in that parking lot talking and planning what was going to happen in the next few hours. "I'll go into the house," explained Billy, "and approach your mom with a bat. I'll make it look like a robbery." So when they left Dunkin' Donuts, Billy drove by the house. Driving slowly, he looked toward the house. Jean's car was in the driveway, so Jean was inside with the pizza, waiting for everyone to come home for dinner, clearly having no idea what awaited her.
Not at all. When Billy and Nicole realized that Jean was home, Billy made a U-turn and drove back to the house. They took a right into the parking lot of the 7-Eleven and parked where they had a clear view of the house. So they decided to go into the store, but just then a police car pulled up and they got paranoid. So they walked into the store with the officer, then wandered through the aisles, got in line. Standing in line, when Nicole turned around, she noticed the police officer was behind her. So after paying for a magazine, Billy and Nicole walked back to Billy's car and sat there. Nicole was convinced that their plot had been discovered, and the police officer was following them.
Well, if only that were true.
If only. Yep. So Billy pulled out of the parking lot and headed in the direction of Jean, and the police officer pulled out right behind him. So Billy took a right and drove up into another parking lot. And the police car drove by and continued down the street. So a false alarm this time. Maybe, though, they should have taken that as a sign that their plan was not a good plan.
That would have been good, too, yes.
So Billy drove back to the 7-Eleven lot. And with Nicole sitting in the car, Billy walked toward Jean's house. He didn't turn around and Nicole didn't try to stop him. Confrontation with Jean was going to happen. Billy was determined to go through with it. If Nicole had wanted him to stop the plan, she had many chances to do that over the next 10 minutes or so.
Sure, but she didn't.
No.
So, not knowing about any of this, Jean Domenico sat at her dining room table in the kitchen. She'd brought home a cheese pizza for Chris and the kids, and it was on the counter next to her. She was keeping it warm under a towel. Because she was on the Atkins diet, she planned to have a different meal. Now, the door opened and Billy walked in, and Jean looked up at him. Jean had to have been surprised to see Billy there without Nicole, but she did go back to what she was doing. And Billy walked into Charlie's room, where he planned to grab a baseball bat, to hit Janine's head. He thought this would be simple and quick. It actually would be far from that. So when Billy returned with the aluminum bat in his hand, he blurted out that he hated the Yankees. The bat had become a conversation piece for that moment, and Jean commented on another baseball team. Billy put the bat beside the entertainment center in the living room just outside of the kitchen. While talking, Billy and Jean moved into that living room and sat on the couch. Billy picked up the bat and pretended to swing it. "Love those socks," he said, staring down at the bat and gripping it tightly. "Put that down, Billy," said Jean. "It's making me nervous." She seemed very uncomfortable with the way things were going, and she didn't want him swinging the bat in the house. "I used to play baseball, Jean," Billy said. And after Billy made another comment about baseball, he picked up Nicole's cordless phone, which had a separate line in the house, and he called his cell phone, which Nicole had. Nicole was still sitting in his car at the 7-Eleven. "What's going on?" she asked him. "She's getting nervous," whispered Billy, talking about Jean, who had now walked into another part of the house and she couldn't hear him. "You're not going to do it, are you?" asked Nicole. Jean knew who Billy was talking to. "Is that Nicole?" she asked him, walking into the area of the house where Billy was standing and talking. "You tell her to get her ass home," Jean said. Billy hung up the phone and carried on talking about baseball, trying to keep Jean preoccupied and focused on him rather than Nicole. And as he spoke, Jean moved the conversation back to Nicole, demanding to know why she wasn't with him. "What's going on here, Billy?" Jean asked him. And then Nicole's cordless telephone rang. Billy picked it up. He knew it was Nicole, and Nicole sounded anxious. "There's a cop at the bank," she said as Billy walked away from Jean and into another section of the house. Billy remained calm. "Is he taking money out of the ATM?" And Nicole said, "Yes, he was." So Billy told her, "Don't worry about it. Everything will be okay. I'll be out soon. Bye, Nicole." And he hung up. Nicole did not try and call him back. She didn't try and stop him. But by now, Jean was getting upset. And according to Billy, she started screaming at him as he walked back into the kitchen from the living room. She was yelling, "Why isn't Nicole with you? Where is she?" Billy told her Nicole was across the street. And again, Jean told him to tell Nicole to get home for dinner. Now that comment from Jean apparently started an argument between them, according to Billy. Billy would say that from then on, everything went wrong. Everything he and Nicole had talked about over the past 4 days, including living together, getting married, running away, and hoping something would happen to Jean, was on his mind. And he knew he could either walk away or attack Jean then. So Billy had yelled at her that Nicole was picking something up at the store and that he was there to get his inhaler. Jean then walked back into the kitchen to get what Billy said was a roast beef and cheese sandwich, which was part of her diet. She was walking back and forth, he said, from the living room to the kitchen, and she was complaining about having to be on that diet. Billy felt Jean's anger was directed at the fact that he was standing there and Nicole wasn't there, and he said that made him even angrier. So they continued arguing about Nicole, Billy said, but he couldn't remember the exact words that Jean had spoken to him. As they yelled back and forth, Billy said there was a point of no return for him. Billy insisted that all he could see was Jean's mouth moving, couldn't hear anything. He wasn't listening to the words and couldn't understand them. It was an argument, Billy admitted, that he had probably provoked just to build up the guts to finish what he had set out to do to Jean.
So as Billy continued to argue with Jean, she walked over and shut the door to the upstairs in order to keep the air conditioning from going upstairs. Then Billy confronted her with the bat in his hand, and he swung, planning to hit her in the head. Instead, he missed and hit her across her back. Now, the impact pushed Jean against the wall and startled her, but she didn't fall down. So after Jean realized what had happened, she turned, holding her side. This violence wasn't something she had expected. She knew Billy was unstable and had told her friends that there was something about him that just wasn't right, but she never thought he was capable of such violence. Billy later said after he struck Jean in the back, he then swung again and hit her in the head, and the medical examiner's report supports this. Crime scene photos would show a large laceration in the back of Jean's skull. Billy thought that he had now exposed his true self to Jean, so there's no way she's going to let him see Nicole again.
You think?
Jeez, brilliant. So in his mind, he really had nothing left to lose. He threw himself at Jean, and they both fell on a coffee table in the living room and broke it. Billy claimed that it was a struggle to keep Jean on the floor because she was a lot stronger than she looked. At one point, Jean even managed to get out of his grasp and run for the kitchen door.
Yeah, oddly, while Billy and Jean fought inside the house, Nicole sat in Billy's car and read the magazine she'd bought at the 7-Eleven. Jean had almost made it to the door, but Billy was close, and he pulled her back into the house. When she fell to the floor, she did try and get up, but Billy pushed her down again. Then Billy ran into the kitchen and grabbed a steak knife off the counter. Then, running back at Jean with the knife, he stabbed her in her right shoulder, burying the knife down to the bone, using so much force that the knife blade broke off. Then Billy grabbed a second knife from the butcher block set Jean had been so against keeping in her house. He went straight for Jean's upper body and stabbed her in the throat. Billy said then he just couldn't stop himself from going after her. He even fantasized that there was something he could do to make Jean just lose her memory, so she wouldn't have to die, but she'd forget what happened. So when Billy struck Jean with the second knife, he dropped it on the floor. Then she got up, picked up the knife, and ran at him. But when she tried to stab him, she slipped on her own blood, he said, and she went head first into the glass part of the door. Billy then grabbed a third knife and frantically stabbed at her. He kept stabbing until Jean stopped moving. Billy remembered stabbing Jean 8 times. But the medical examiner counted 40 stab wounds. 2 in Jean's back, 1 on her wrist, 7 to her chest and throat, 6 to her face, 13 on the right side of her head, 2 on the left side of her head, and 9 in the back of her neck and head. When Billy finally stopped stabbing her, he ran for the door. What he didn't notice was that he had left bloody prints on the knives and the baseball bat and a palm print on the refrigerator. So this was very sloppy, and investigators believe that all this happened during the fight. He had also left a large handprint on the living room carpet and several bloody footprints on the floor. Billy said he could hear Jean still struggling to breathe when he went out the door. She did have a punctured lung in addition to all of her other wounds, and Billy, of course, was covered with her blood. Nicole was still in Billy's car wondering what was going on and why he was taking so long. Billy was panicking as he stood by the door, wondering what he should do next. He was absolutely covered with blood. He needed to change his clothes, get back to the car, and then leave town. So he walked over Jean's body and ran up the stairs, leaving a path of bloody footprints. When he got upstairs, Billy grabbed a jacket. Then he ran downstairs. He spread the jacket on the floor and took off and piled his bloody clothes into it. Then he went into the bathroom to wash the blood off his hands, face, and arms before putting on a clean set of clothes. But he still had quite a bit of blood.
Oh, yeah.
After he did get dressed, he ran out the door into the 7-Eleven. Nicole was leaning against the car reading her magazine. Billy told her it was done. He said that he had left his inhaler in the house and he needed a towel, so she was going to have to go back inside the house.
Why her? Had Billy had enough?
I think
mayhem.
He was done. Yeah, he said, it's your turn.
So he pulled out of the 7-Eleven lot, driving about 60 miles an hour, made a sharp right turn onto Dumaine. He told Nicole that she had to go into the house for him. He needed a wet towel to get more blood off himself. Nicole was crying, and she said she didn't want to see her mother, and she couldn't believe he had actually killed Jean.
Well, yeah, but she wasn't terribly upset, because the next thing she said, according to Billy, was, well, now we're going to be together. And Billy would say she seemed happy and relieved. So Billy pulled into Jean's driveway and told Nicole to meet him back at the 7-Eleven. As Billy pulled out of the driveway, Nicole walked toward the house. But after opening the screen door, she tried to push open the main door into the house, but it wouldn't move because something was blocking it.
Yeah, so she forced it open in a crack and saw that it was her mother's dead body that was blocking the door from opening. So this shocked her, and she backed away. But then, as she's standing there, she reminded herself that Billy was counting on her. So she did manage to push the door open, walked in, saw blood all over the room. After going into the bathroom, grabbing a towel and wetting it, she headed for the door. She noticed the broken knife blade on the floor, so she picked it up as she left. She ran toward the bank parking lot where Billy was now parked. On the other side of Billy's car, there was a sewer drain. So Nicole dropped the knife blade into the drain and got into the car.
Well, just down the road from Jean's house was the Pheasant Lane Mall. Billy parked there after stopping by an ATM to withdraw some money. He told Nicole to go into the mall and get him some clothes. Nicole was shaking and crying at this point, but she agreed. After buying a shirt, Nicole ran out to the parking lot and hopped back into Billy's car. Next, Billy stopped at the JCPenney store just up the street. Nicole went in and bought a pair of pants and socks for him. She put the receipt in her front pocket. Billy then drove to the AMC movie theater so he could change clothes in the back parking lot where it was dark. When Billy finished getting dressed, they took off for Massachusetts. They drove through the country roads until Billy came to the entrance to Overlook Golf Course in Hollis. He pulled into the driveway and found a dirt road which led into a wooded area. Billy pulled into a secluded area and popped his trunk. Then Nicole jumped out, grabbed everything in the trunk she could find, and put them into a bag. She found a tree and tossed the bag behind it. As they drove away from Overlook, Billy suggested they go see Rebecca, Jean's best friend, to set up their alibi. So this would have been around 10 o'clock.
Yeah, and so after they visited with Rebecca, Billy drove back to Nashua. He wanted to drive by the house to see what was going on. So he stopped at the Dunkin' Donuts and told Nicole to make sure the trunk was empty. Standing underneath the parking lot lights, she noticed the handle of a knife, and she picked that up and threw it in the bushes.
There's handprints and palm prints and evidence everywhere. It's so ridiculous.
You know they're going to get caught anyway.
Well, of course we know that.
And before they drove back to the house, Billy had Nicole promise him that she would never tell anyone what had happened. Yeah, that'll last until the police start questioning.
Yeah.
So Billy Sullivan and Nicole Kaczynskis were each charged with first-degree murder and conspiracy. And it was decided that Nicole would be charged as an adult.
Which is pretty funny, because that was all she wanted, right? Was to be emancipated and be an adult. So after the murder, she got what she wanted.
Yeah, for the wrong reasons.
Absolutely.
They both faced life with no possibility of parole, which is the automatic sentence for first-degree murder in New Hampshire.
So Billy wrote to several different girls all over New England while he was incarcerated and awaiting trial. A pattern of behavior became very clear with him. Billy met young girls, told them what they wanted to hear, and then manipulated them into doing what he wanted. One girl, who was only 15 years old at the time, ended up testifying for the prosecution at Billy's trial. She said that Billy had written her over 100 letters from prison, and Billy had told this girl that he would marry her if she would just convince Nicole to testify that someone else had killed Jean. But Nicole accepted a plea deal, and she testified against Billy. She was sentenced to 40 years with 5 years reduced if she completed an education program while in prison. She had 2.5 years taken off her sentence for furthering her education, and the terms of her deal allow her to seek a further reduction after she serves 2/3 of her sentence, which won't be until 2031. Chris McGowan told a local news correspondent that he felt Nicole was just as guilty as Billy and should have been sentenced the same as Billy Sullivan was.
Well, sure, but she threw in the towel first and got the plea deal. It could have worked the opposite.
Yeah, although Billy did it, so I think it makes it easier for her to testify against him, since he physically did it.
Right, but he could have taken advantage. I guess what I'm thinking is that she spoke up first and took the plea bargain.
I don't know, because they were in separate rooms. They were both confessing. I just think since she was 16 and he physically did the murder, she seemed like the one to give the plea deal to.
Yeah, I would also say that she's 16 and she'd be the one more likely to roll over on her boyfriend.
True. That's true, too. Chris had gained a lot of weight since Jean died, and he had a difficult time socializing and even just going to work. He didn't leave his house much, and he had to begin going to therapy. He did try dating, but he said nobody could live up to the happiness he had found with Jean. She was one in a million, he said later, and I don't care how cliched that sounds. That was Jean. There will never be another woman in my life like Jean. There were many times when Chris drove around in his car listening to the same music he and Jean had enjoyed together. And when he felt he needed to talk to her or get close to her, he often made a 2-hour trip to her grave in Massachusetts and sat and thought about the time that they'd had together. Jean's death really did damage Chris's desire to move on in life. Even after 2 years, he still couldn't imagine his life with another woman.
The judge said to Nicole at her sentencing, William Sullivan may be a psychopath, but there's one thing that's very clear to me in this case. The murder of your mother wouldn't have happened without your complicity. So Billy's trial took place in 2005. His defense attorney said that Nicole knew that Billy was a ticking time bomb and she had manipulated him to kill her mother for her. The defense presented Billy's psychological issues and the fact that he had not been taking his medications as prescribed, and these were reasons for his violent behavior. Odds were certainly against Billy, but his lawyers prepared to show jurors that he had a long history of mental illness. And they also planned to argue that Billy suffered from bipolar disorder, depression, and other psychiatric problems long before he met Nicole. After beginning his relationship with Nicole, his defense claimed that the strain Billy was put under exacerbated his mental capacity to be able to discern right from wrong.
Yeah, so Billy pleaded not guilty due to reason of insanity, which we know hardly ever works. He had experienced a difficult childhood, and he had witnessed domestic violence in his household. By the time he was 16, his mental illness seemed to be under control, though, with therapy and medications. But then he stopped taking his medication regularly, so his lawyers claimed that he was incompetent to stand trial. But in the end, the judge disagreed, and the trial went forward. In July 2005, Billy was convicted of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Nicole's biological father, Anthony Kaczynskis, was the only person from Nicole's family to sit behind her at her hearing. But he couldn't stand behind what she'd done, he told her. Everything that everybody has said in this courtroom, think about it, he told Nicole. What you and Billy did haunts a lot of people. I hope it haunts both of you. You changed a lot of people's lives. Think about it, he said. You have plenty of time.
Billy's appeals have failed. Nicole attempted to have her sentence commuted in 2020, but she was turned down by a vote of 3-2. Chris McGowan carries a string of rosary beads made from the roses he sent Jean Domenico on the day before she was murdered. He had meant for the flowers to be delivered August 14, 2003, which was the third anniversary of the day he'd met Jean. By mistake, the florist sent them to the office where they both worked on August 5th. Which is the day after he placed the order.
Right, and the day before she died.
So if not for this mistake, she would have been dead before receiving the flowers.
Yeah, so he kind of saw that as some kind of serendipity, I guess. So TCB's music was produced by Mike McClellan. You can find out more about his work at his website, podcastps.com. If you have comments, a case suggestion, or maybe even a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com, or even better, leave us a voicemail. I'll put a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail for a future show. If you'd like to support our show and get our episodes ad-free, plus get a special members-only episode each and every month, please go to tygrabber.com and take a look at our subscribing options. They're very inexpensive, and there are over 150 shows in our members-only TCB premium feed for your listening and binging pleasure. And you also have the option of subscribing through Patreon by going to patreon.com/tygrabber. Now, either way, you'll get your own personal subscription link that you can paste into your podcast app, so you can listen there as well as on our website without any commercials or promos. So you won't have to listen to me talking about this anymore either. So think it over. You might find it's worth it.
It's time for listener feedback.
So we have some great feedback to share with you today. What have we got, Dickie?
Today we have a couple voicemails and one email. And the first voicemail is from Matt, and he has a case suggestion. I think he also threw in a beer suggestion there, too.
Sounds good.
Hi, Jill and Dick. Matt here from Harrisville, Rhode Island, little town that is home to the Conjuring House. Just want to say that I love the podcast. I listen to you guys to and from work. I have about an hour commute each day, 6 days a week. So fills up the time to and from home. Keep up the great work. I do have a case suggestion. I'm not sure if you guys have done it because I do bounce around in the podcast. I do not hate to say listen to them in order. It's the Emery case here in Rhode Island. I think it was from 1990, around that time. Sure, you must have heard of it, being former New Englanders. It involved a road rage incident, I believe, and a murder. And then there's the, if I remember correctly, there is a videotape of the courtroom after the conviction where he is talking to his wife, Adam Emery. And there's always been controversy of what they were actually saying to each other. If you don't know the story, it does lead to a supposed suicide. They supposedly jumped off the Newport Bridge, but only, if I remember correctly, she was found. He has never been found. And I do believe he's still considered a fugitive. So I have not seen this case done in any podcast. Again, I'm not sure if you have done it. If you do, great. But I would like to hear it. I do recommend that you look into this case or what your take is on it. And I do have a beer recommendation for Dick. Right now, currently, as I speak, I'm drinking something called Lamplighter, and it's Super Bloom, which is a pale ale. Just discovered this a few weeks ago. It's actually pretty good. It's out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm not sure if you've ever tried it, but I suggest giving it a chance. It's pretty good. That's it. Hope you guys are well. Have a great Easter, and keep up the great work. Bye.
Well, thank you, Matt. That's a nice accent. That's a Rhode Island accent?
I don't know.
Isn't that where he said he's from?
Well, he's living in there. I don't know if he said he was from there.
I think it's a Rhode Island accent, because that's a little bit different than a Massachusetts accent or a Maine accent.
Definitely.
I really like it a lot. I also love those Conjuring movies, right?
Those
are fun.
Crazy.
Yeah.
This looks like an interesting thing to consider. As Matt said, this is a road rage killing. Adam Emery and his wife and another couple were having dinner, and a car sideswiped Emery's car. So he jumped after them, or jumped away from the table, pursued them, and got in an argument and stabbed the guy to death.
Wow.
Then it turns out that it was the wrong guy. It wasn't the guy who had actually hit his car.
Okay, but I'd say either way, it was not the right thing to do.
Either way, it was maybe a bit of an overreaction.
Yeah, I don't really understand the whole road rage thing.
Me either.
No, I mean, I can see yelling and calling names, but I never try and interact or anything or give the finger, because you never know what you're dealing with. Crazy people out there.
There's a lot of them.
Yes.
So he was found guilty, I think, of manslaughter or second degree, whatever. He was found guilty.
Okay.
And he was out on bail waiting for sentencing when he and his wife jumped off the bridge. They left suicide notes and off they went.
Well, come on, there had to be more going on than that.
Well, that's what we're going to have to learn about.
Yeah, that's really something. Why would the wife be part of that?
I have no idea why she would have done that with him. And it gets more interesting. As Matt said, her body or her skull was recovered somewhere down the road. His remains have never been found. He was declared dead, but the FBI is still looking for him because I think there's been numerous sightings of him. And they think he's in Europe or Italy somewhere where he has family.
Interesting.
Isn't it?
So he may have killed his wife and run off. We don't know.
Well, I don't know. Yeah.
Do we know that they both jumped off that bridge? Actually, did someone see that happen?
I'm not sure.
Interesting.
Apparently they did jump off. Although, if that's the case, how did he know he might survive?
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot of questions there. So we're going to look into that.
Got to look into this.
Yeah.
It was... had a lot of good elements in it that sounded like it would be interesting to do.
Yeah, it seems very different. So what about the beer? Let's get to the important stuff here, right?
I've never had one of those beers. Maybe it's a relatively new brewing company. If we do go to Maine this summer, I'll look for it.
Okay, great. That is the one thing about down here. We don't have the beer selection. New England has a lot of beers, a lot of good beers.
Yes, I got spoiled.
Yes, you did. Okay, let's play another voicemail.
Okay, and this one's from Allison. And she also has a case suggestion.
And this looks like a short one.
It is a short one.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Allison from Hillsborough, New Jersey. Happy Easter. I'm sitting here drinking mimosas. And I recently became a tie grabber. For some reason, my husband and I started talking about the murder-suicide of Bryn and Phil Hartman. My grandmother had a boyfriend who actually used to go drinking with Phil in Canada. I thought that would be a pretty good case to do. Anyway, hope you think about it. I love you guys. Bye.
Thanks, Allison. We love you too. That's just a great suggestion. Chris, we do know quite a bit about this case. I did read a book about it at one point. Super sad.
Yeah, you were at the point of getting ready to do an episode on this.
I was. You know, sometimes I pick up a case and I start doing it and I think, you know, it's just making me depressed. I can't do it right now. And then I come back to it.
So this might be one to do.
It could be one we could come back to, sure. I appreciate the suggestion.
All right. And then we have one email from Nicole.
All right. This is a case suggestion. And Nicole writes, "Hi, Dick and Jill. I really enjoy your podcast. You do a fabulous job with your research and presenting the cases you cover." Thank you very much, Nicole. "I have a case suggestion from my childhood hometown. It's the case of Lori Eisenberg. This takes place in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. She was embezzling money from a coalition and also murdered her husband to cover it all up by drugging him and throwing him off of their boat in the middle of winter on Lake Coeur d'Alene. It's a crazy story. I hope you'll consider it. Thanks for all your effort, Nicole." Well, thanks, Nicole. Thanks for your effort of writing in with a great case suggestion. We actually saw a Dateline on this, I believe.
We have. It's a very interesting story. Lori Eisenberg was embezzling money from a housing coalition. This is a Northern Idaho housing coalition that was to help lower-income families be able to purchase homes. She embezzled over $500,000 from the coalition over a period of time.
So not a nice lady.
No. She also had daughters that were probably helping her.
Oh, that's pretty shocking. Now, were they her husband's daughters, or was this a second marriage?
No, this is a second marriage.
Okay.
He had two children from his first marriage, and she had, I don't know, four or six kids from her marriage.
Yeah, I can remember from the show, she's pretty crazy, pretty loopy.
She drugged him and threw him off the boat. He had a truckload of Benadryl in his system, which was presumably the cause of death because he had no water in his lungs, so he was dead before he hit the water.
Gosh, how much Benadryl would it take to kill a person, though? That would be a lot.
It had to have been a ton. I mean, his levels were 1,000 times above therapeutic. It was just an incredible amount of Benadryl in his body. I don't know how he could ingest that much.
Well, one thing is that she claimed later that she was going to kill herself, so she had filled her cup, her beverage cup, with the Benadryl. And he accidentally got it by drinking her drink.
Right.
Which no one believes that bullshit at all.
No.
That is totally a lie and disgusting lie, really, because she said it in front of his family.
Yeah, the other thing she did, which makes it more interesting to me, is that she changed his will.
Oh, and she forged things.
She forged it so that 80% of his estate was going to go to her daughters.
Eh.
And only 20% would end up going to his children.
Well, that would be questionable in any circumstance.
Yeah. So, and this was just some quick reviewing of stuff. We saw the Dateline.
Yes.
I think there's a Snapped episode on it also. We'll see.
Yeah, let's see what we can find on that.
Let's check it out.
She seems like a crazy evil broad.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Well, thanks, Nicole. Great suggestion. Thank you, everyone, for writing and leaving voicemails. I've decided for the month of May, if you call in and have your voicemail played, we're going to send you a free bottle opener, which our bottle openers are really cool. You can look on our website and take a look at them. They're the kind that can fit in your wallet, and they're very solid steel. They've got our logo on them. So if you want to get a free bottle opener, what you can do is just call in with your voicemail. If we play it on the show, then you just send us an email with your address, and we'll send you that. Probably a sticker, too, right? That's our effort to get more voicemails. Because now that we're doing the show every other week, I thought we could make feedback a little more in-depth, a little bit longer.
So get those voicemails coming in.
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We'll save some seats for you.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.